This is Vandana Shiva, and you're listening to the Enviro Show. Remember, listen to your mother.
Greetings, Earthlings. It's a Coming Home Enviro Show. I'm one of your co-hosts, Dio. And I am not in the studio with...
Hey, this is Wild Glenn Ayers.
He's a wild man. So we follow up our Earth Day activities with an Earth-based story that warms the heart and stirs the soul. Rob Edward, president of Rocky Mountain Wolf Action Fund, joins us to talk about the reintroduction of wolves to Colorado. Some humans wiped them out. Other humans brought them back. So we'll see how that's going. Stay tuned. But first, it's time for... Revenge of the Critters. All right, we interrupt this broadcast to say a new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences finds that climate change could lead to even greater human-elephant conflict in the future. Is even more, and it's even more troubling. So this Revenge of the Critters, folks, I'm sorry, we have no gallows humor about elephant and human conflict, just the facts. The problem, of course, is not new. People and elephants have long struggled to coexist as humans slowly encroached on the African and Asian habitats of the planet's largest land mammal. Elephants need up to 150 kilograms, that's 330 pounds, of food each day, and up to 190 liters, 50 gallons, of water every day. Their pursuit of sustenance, as their habitats and corridors continue to be cleared away for farms and development, inevitably leads to conflict with humans. Given the animal size and power, these run-ins often include the destruction of homes and farms in places where people already struggle to make ends meet. In India alone, roughly 500,000 families a year lose crops to elephants. The study, the first large-scale projection of how rising temperatures and expanding human footprint could affect the relationship between people and pachyderms, analyzed known hotspots for human and elephant conflict in Africa and Asia to predict how the risk and severity of these conflicts could change amid alternative futures, one with high greenhouse gas emissions and greater deforestation, population and agricultural expansion, the other with much less reliance on fossil fuels, greater conservation of forest, and a lower agricultural footprint. There it is. That's our Revenge of the Critters for this show.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out that those large herbivores that have been removed from most of the world, because remember, right, 96-97% of the vertebrate terrestrial biomass is now humans and their livestock animals, and 4% of the remaining terrestrial vertebrate biomass is wildlife. So we have wiped out so much of the wild life that the function of all of those animals has been removed. The animals have been removed and their ecosystem functions have been removed. And animals are not just ecosystem functions, but many plants, many terrestrial plants co-evolved with these animals, and a lot of them had to pass through the digestive tract of these large herbivores. The seeds had to pass through in order for them to germinate. Right. And we've lost that. We've lost that now for a long time. And so many of those plants no longer reproduce. Yes, their habitat has been wiped out as well, but the ability for them to germinate has been removed because they co-evolved with these other animals that have been removed from the landscape. And so that's something to keep in mind as we're talking about rewilding. When we talk about the need for keystone species like the elephant and like many of the things we're going to be talking about later in the show, the gray wolf, those keystone species provide these kinds of benefits to the ecosystem that have been missing for 100 years. And if we're going to rewild areas, we're going to have to return those functions to the land as well.
Right. Oh, and it's time for the EnviroShow Quote of the Week. And for a change, my co-host Glenn Ayers is going to take this one on. He found it, and he should read it, I guess.
All right. Well, this is in totally in line with our interview about wolves. And this is a really famous quote from Aldo Leopold, who, if you've never read a Sand County Almanac, I highly recommend getting a copy of that book. It should be in every used bookstore. And it is one of the best reads. It is it's a very simple book. It's very easy read, but it is very deep as far as ecology goes. So this is a quote from a part of that book called Thinking Like a Mountain and a chapter in the book. And this is a quote. We reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then, and I have known ever since, that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and to the mountain. I was young then and full of trigger itch. I thought that because fewer wolves meant more deer, that no wolves would mean hunter's paradise. But after seeing the green fire die, I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with such a view. Close quote.
Bravo, Aldo Leopold.
Yeah, and that was a story that he tells in that chapter about seeing a wolf with a bunch of pups from across a valley and a bunch of them just opening fire and shooting the wolf and shooting the pups and then going across to the other side of the valley, and that's when they reached the wolf in time to watch the fierce green fire fade from her eyes. And that really is a kind of an allegory or a story about how we have wiped out the wild and the impact that that has caused. And so that is something that we'll talk about at length in the interview, and the fact that the wolves missing from the land, from the wild, have removed a key part of evolution from the landscape. And returning that, restoring that back to the land, increases the health of the land. And Leopold talked a lot about that in Sand County Almanac, about land as a community. And I think that what we talk about in the interview really fits into that narrative that we need to be rewilding, we need to be restoring and reintroducing. And we should keep in mind that, yes, we live in a very populated, densely populated New England area, Massachusetts. But if we don't make room for the wild, if we are unable to coexist with all the other critters that should be living on the land with us, then we are missing so much. And that's the idea of rewilding and restoring and reintroducing those missing parts back to the land. And then, of course, we have to learn how to live peacefully in coexistence with the wild, which is where humanity emerged from over hundreds of thousands of years. We evolved in the wilderness, and now we live apart from the natural world. And that is to the detriment of everyone, not only the animals that we have removed, wiped out, extirpated, or caused to go extinct, but actually from the health of the land itself, we are removed. And so this is an interview that talks about that effort to restore balance back into an area that clearly needs it. But we also need to keep in mind that we have the same needs here in New England as they do in Colorado. It's going to be maybe harder to do it in New England, but maybe not, because we are supposedly much more liberal than the Western states. And we should have a culture that is more accepting. I'm amazed that they were able to accomplish what they did over the past 30 years in Colorado. Maybe it won't take us that long to be able to do something like that in New England. You know, you can think of the Adirondacks, for instance, as an experiment in rewilding. And so let's keep that in mind when we listen to this interview and try to envision, try to have a vision of how we can accomplish something this great in our eastern wild lands that may not be wild right now, but they have the potential to be rewilded again. Today on the Enviro Show, we are joined by Rob Edward, who is one of the champions, I'm going to say, of rewilding. He's headed up the Rocky Mountain Wolf Project for I don't know how many years, Rob. You're going to have to tell us the story behind that. And the fact now that just at the end of last year, wolves were reintroduced into Western Colorado for the first time in almost 100 years, 75 years plus, that wolves have been extirpated from the state. And when I lived in Colorado back in the 80s, there was a lot of anti-wolf sentiment amongst the state agencies, amongst the Forest Service. And over the past three decades, Rob, you have accomplished what I, from my perspective, consider to be a miracle. So tell us about the Rocky Mountain Wolf Project, and then give us kind of a snapshot, historical run-up through the last three decades of how you have accomplished what has happened in Colorado related to having wild wolves running around on the public lands of Western Colorado.
Thanks for having me today, Glenn. I am excited to talk to you about this. I am excited that I'm talking to you because, quite frankly, I owe it to you and the small crew of people that you got together with back before I even got to Colorado in the early 1990s. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that initial work and cage rattling and rabble rousing that you guys did. So I'm honored to be able to talk to you about this today. As you mentioned, my name's Rob Edward. I am one of the co-founders of the Rocky Mountain Wolf Project. We've been an organization in one form or another for about 10 years now. We have been an agent of change in a couple of different ways. One was through forming a sister organization called the Rocky Mountain Wolf Action Fund, which was a special organization designed simply to run a ballot initiative. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. And then the Wolf Project is carrying the wolf work forward for decades and decades to come, because now that we have reintroduction actively happening in Colorado, and it will happen in iterative phases over the next several years, and the more wolves we have here, the more work there's going to be to do, because wolves and humans have a complicated relationship. But the path to having wolves reintroduced, as you mentioned, was at least 30 years long. My path was 30 years long. I came to Colorado in late 1994 from Massachusetts. And in fact, I was working at the New England Aquarium for a while and went to UMass Boston for my undergraduate degree. And I read an article for a little nonprofit based in Boulder called Synopu, which is the word for wolves. And I read that ad in the Earth First Journal. And they were calling for somebody to come out and help them build a constituency for wolves. And I was excited about the opportunity to come back to the West. I'm a native of Idaho originally. So once I had a conversation with your longtime friend, Michael Robinson, I got the job and came out in November of 1994 and was off to the races. I think for a lot of people who aren't every day in the trenches of social change, talking about something that's been a 30-year arc might be a little puzzling. Why did it take so long? Well, what you have to understand is that the issue of why wolves weren't in Colorado in 1994 when I came here, you have to look backwards to European conquest of the interior of the United States, the concept of manifest destiny, and the effort to essentially subdue the native peoples, to subdue the land, all of the things that went into those efforts, like wiping out the bison, sending all the elk and deer back east to the market, and the wolves population, in the absence of their native prey, then turned to depredating on livestock. And we were putting livestock out into the interior West by the train loads every day during the 1800s and early 1900s. So, of course, they're just other hoofed mammals, and wolves and grizzly bears turned to eating livestock because that's all they had to eat. But of course, that got sideways with the burgeoning livestock industry. And ultimately, by the early 1900s, the livestock industry had convinced Congress to appropriate several hundred thousand dollars for the eradication of wolves in America, especially in the West. That was Pentagon-level spending at the time. And by 1914, they started sending young men out West as wolfers to track down every last single wolf, trap them out, shoot them, track them to their dens, dig out their pups, beat their pups to death with shovels, put cyanide and strychnine everywhere across the landscape to kill any wolves that they didn't actually see. And so by 1940, very few wolves were left in the West. They were extirpated from Yellowstone National Park by 1920. The last wild wolf in Colorado that we know of was in the South San Juan Mountains, and it was killed in 1945. So the end of World War II was when Colorado had its last wild wolf. So that's the context that drove the creation of that little group called Synopu and the effort to restore wolves to Colorado. When I came to work with Synopu in 1994, the effort to restore wolves to Yellowstone and central Idaho was just about to launch in early 1995. They put the first wolves in the pens in Yellowstone and dumped a few out in central Idaho as well, and they were off to the races. And the cultural conflict exploded because, of course, the general thought process of a lot of folks in the rural areas of the West was that their ancestors had wiped wolves out for a reason and that nobody should have any reason to bring them back. And it's that conflict that ultimately caused the arc of trying to get wolves back to Colorado to take 3 decades. Because we had to work very carefully through that process of social change and marrying that dialogue with the public to solid science. So one of the first things that I did when I came to Colorado was to hook up with a friend that I'd met here once I got here, who was working on GIS mapping, computer mapping. And he was very excited about the idea of perhaps mapping the best wolf habitat in Colorado. And I said, so what does that look like? And he said, well, so what we would do if we can, we would get the data from the Colorado Division of Wildlife for elk and deer winter and summer range in Colorado. And then we would take those layers of data and we would marry them with layers of data for public and private land ownership and road density. And we would give a weighted average for areas that had less roads and were publicly owned and had more elk presence over the winter and summer combined. So after several months of working through those mapping iterations, we came out with some really interesting maps that showed a tremendous amount of potential for wolf presence in Western Colorado. And it wasn't the first time that wolf presence in Colorado had been studied. In fact, I think when the work that you did initially in the late 80s, early 90s ended up causing CSU to do an analysis of potential wolf habitat or wolf capacity. And they said that Colorado had the capacity to support over 1,000 wolves. So we already knew that the basic science said we probably have plenty of elk and deer for wolves, and we have a decent amount of public and private land, but we took it a step further and actually mapped it out. And when we mapped it out and saw what it showed, how completely amazing Western Colorado looked from a wolf's perspective, we decided to reach out to Mike Phillips, who was one of the two lead biologists on the Yellowstone wolf reintroduction, and send him these maps. He didn't know us from Adam. He just had taken a job with Ted Turner to start the Turner Endangered Species Fund. But we emailed these maps to him, and he reached back out via phone almost immediately and said, "Is this really what you're telling me, that those red blobs are good wolf habitat?" And we said, "Yes. I mean, we've checked it back and forth several times, and it just keeps coming out the same way. And here's the criteria: low road density, high public land ownership, and plenty of elk. Colorado has the largest elk population in North America and one of the largest deer populations. There's plenty of wild game for wolves to eat, and we have over 70% of the western part of the state is in federal public land ownership of one form or another. So why shouldn't we have wolves there again?" And we were off to the races with Mike Phillips and the Turner Endangered Species Fund advocating for getting those maps parlayed into something that could be peer-reviewed and published. We worked with Dr. Carlos Carroll and did a couple of different rounds of journal papers about the capacity for wolves in Western Colorado. While all of that's happening, I'm then turning my attention to building a constituency for wolves. And it was obvious that the public very strongly supported bringing wolves back to Colorado. Not necessarily everybody on the Western Slope, but the vast majority of people in Colorado supported bringing wolves back. We had polling data from the early 1990s, and then more polling data in the late 1990s that confirmed that. So then I took that and started working with the Colorado Division of Wildlife, arguing that they should get ahead of the curve before the federal government comes in to force reintroduction, that maybe the Parks and Wildlife Department should simply say, "We're going to do this our way," and get ahead of the federal government. They chose not to do that. They instead impaneled a group called the Wolf Working Group, which I was a part of, included ranchers and hunters and some environmentalists. And we wrangled for about 6 months and came up with a consensus statement that basically said that if wolves wander into Colorado on their own, they can do so freely and should be left to their own devices. And if they cause any problems, those problems should be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. And that was great, but that wasn't where we wanted to go with this. We knew that southern Wyoming was a killing zone, that wolves that wander out of Yellowstone south are facing a gauntlet of guns and other perils. So it wasn't likely that Colorado was going to see recolonization naturally. In fact, interestingly, both Washington, Oregon, and California all received wolves through natural recolonization in the 2000s, yet Colorado remained wolf-free.
So, Rob, the whole idea of getting the public to agree to this eventually led you to propose a ballot initiative, which I think is an amazing way for the public to weigh in. You can do polls and you can do letters to the editor, but actually getting something on the ballot for people to vote for really gives them something real to do. And can you talk about how that came about?
Well, there'd been discussion about potentially taking the issue to the ballot for years. As early as 2000, Michael Robinson and Chuck Romanello and I had discussed the possibility of doing that, but ultimately decided that there was more work to be done in building the case and doing our due diligence. Ultimately, though, what tipped the balance in favor of going to the ballot was that it was obvious that the Fish and Wildlife Service at the federal level was not interested in doing any more reintroductions. And it was obvious that at the state level, despite Colorado being increasingly purple to blue politically, that the political framework that was established clear back when Colorado was created as a state was not going to let that happen. because rural power is so significantly entrenched by the very fact that there are so many rural districts in the state. And so the legislature wasn't going to allow it. And the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission, through legislative frame, was composed of so much livestock and sport killing interests that there was no way that we could see in the next many decades we were going to have the Parks and Wildlife Department push for doing reintroduction. So it was a last ditch effort, but we took nearly 30 years to do our due diligence. Nobody could say we didn't try. We decided we were going to go to the ballot. We believed we had strong public support. And by 2019, we were out there collecting signatures. We had 6 months to do it. We overshot the required number of signatures by several tens of thousands, and we were on the ballot in 2020. Of course, we were gearing up for a traditional ground campaign, door to door, out there talking to people, raising money like crazy. And then in March 2020, everything shut down. And the game changed completely. So suddenly we could not run a traditional ground campaign. And we were forced to essentially run the entire campaign online. We were in a very difficult position in terms of raising money to do any sort of paid media advertising in favor of the campaign. But nonetheless, we were already on the ballot, so we were going to run this campaign. And, we'd already raised and spent almost $1.5 million just getting the question on the ballot. And we weren't going to let those people who'd invested in that down. And so we retooled and changed our focus and then started dealing with a lot of the craziness that was coming at us from the opposition, including the Safari Club and the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and all the ag interests who were putting out op-eds saying that wolves were going to carry coronavirus to Colorado and that they had this crazy tapeworm, which is totally endemic in wild canids anyway. It's not like a new thing in the West. All these different arguments, and many of the same arguments we've been fighting for 30 years. You know, wolves are going to wipe out livestock and put ranchers out of business. There hasn't been a single rancher go out of business because of wolves in the Northern Rockies. The depredation rate on livestock is a fraction of a percent annually. The elk and deer population in the Northern Rocky Mountains is better than it was before wolves were reintroduced. So all of the doomsaying that's been going on for 30 years certainly wasn't materializing, and it was our job to just continue to put that in front of the public.
So, Rob, stepping back a little, could you tell our listeners about the need for wolves in a healthy biosphere? A lot of people, you know, have this inherited fear of wolves. Could you get into that just a little?
You bet. So what convinced me to move back west from Massachusetts to work on bringing wolves back to Colorado was, well, number one, I saw my first wild wolf in the southern part of the Yukon territories in the early 1990s as I was helping my brother move horses. And so I was enchanted right away. But then I learned about what wolves mean to the systems that they evolved with. And they have a tremendous outsized influence on the health of the landscape and their prey. They affect their prey, of course, because they're predators and they look for infirmities that will allow them to be successful in the hunt. They're extremely skilled at finding those infirmities. Science has proven that now. So they can help keep the elk and deer herds healthy and the bison as well. And because of the way wolves hunt, they hunt as a pack generally. They're not ambush predators. They don't surprise their prey. They actually go out there and test the herd and try to get them to split up. But it's that process of getting out there and causing the herd to go hither and yon and not just stay in one place and browse all the aspen and willow trees down to the ground. It's that process that is so keenly important to the systems that they're a part of. Because with without all those plant communities browse to the ground, you've got more beaver. And when you have more beaver, you have more beaver dams. And when you have more beaver dams, you have deeper, cooler water. So you have better trout habitat and you have more songbirds and so on, a cascading effect throughout the system. That's what turned me on to coming out here and advocating for wolves. It was clearly important. It was the right thing to do. It was clear to me that wiping wolves out was an ecological disaster and an ethical disaster. We had no right as a culture to destroy our fellow beings. No right. They have every right to exist and to be out there keeping the West as wild as possible. So that's why I came west.
Rob, such an incredible story and an accomplishment. And how can folks listening find out more about the Rocky Mountain Wolf Project? And how can they support this effort? I know you said it's taken 3 decades to get to this point, but there's still a lot more that needs to be done. There's going to be additional wolf releases. And just like it started in 1995 in Yellowstone National Park, now in 2023, it has started in western part of Colorado. But eventually, I think, having spent 8 years in Colorado, that to me is such a missing link or a missing keystone to the wildness of the Rocky Mountains. How can folks support that, and how can they follow what you're doing, no matter where they live? You know, obviously in Colorado, sure, they can get the Born to be Wild license plate that will support this effort. But outside of Colorado, how can folks follow this and get on a mailing list or tune into what's happening out there?
Sure. Well, they can visit the Rocky Mountain Wolf Project website at rockymountainwolfproject.org. to learn more about what we do, to sign up for our mailing list. They can go to our Facebook page and follow us there. That's a really good way to stay in touch with what we're doing as well. This is a long-term project. We had a huge milestone crossed in December of this year when the first 10 wolves were released into Western Colorado. But that's just the beginning of a new phase. And the phase going forward is to help Western Colorado adapt to the presence of wolves again, to understand that there is a way to live with wolves on the land and that the sky isn't falling. And that's what the Rocky Mountain Wolf Project is focused on. My colleagues, Matt Barnes, Gary Skiba, Dr. Lambert, and Courtney Vale, they would spend many days every month out working with ranchers on the Western Slope and with the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Department to help ranchers get prepared for the presence of wolves. In some cases, deal with the presence of wolves up in North Park where they already are, helping them use some of these tools that the Born to be Wild plate, which we're very proud of. That plate will help fund these pieces of technology like Fladry and Fox Lights, as well as range riders, people who are familiar with being out with livestock and keeping them and wild carnivores in relative harmony. That's going to be the work that the Rocky Mountain Wolf Project is focused on going forward. That's the only work to be done. The cultural battles will probably be involved in some of the stuff, litigation and things like that, when necessary, but that's not our main focus. Our main focus is helping folks adapt to the presence of wolves and to learn to coexist with them again, because that's how wolves and humans will thrive.
It's great work.
Thank you.
What a testament to perseverance and persistence and keeping your eyes on the prize, never giving up, and following through on a plan, on a strategy. And it's just amazing. I mean, I'm looking back from 35 years ago or so when I was advocating for wolf reintroduction, and to see it actually accomplished, it's an unbelievable dream to see that happen. So I'm just so amazed at what you've accomplished, you know, not just you, but the folks you've been working with for all of these years. And my old accomplices in Colorado, Michael Robinson and all the folks that we're talking about this, the folks at Mission Wolf down in Silver Cliff, they all played a part in this, but
you bet they did.
Just the fact that you accomplished this is an amazing thing.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the work that you did to set the stage for that. And I think in the big picture, for anybody working on any kind of social change in environmental justice or wildlife conservation or fighting racism and fighting against demagogues of every kind, this is a lesson that you, when you're young and vibrant and full of fire and you want to change the world and you start beating your head against that wall every day and grinding and grinding and grinding, and so many times you are going to want to give up and walk away and say, somebody else is going to have to do this. It's not me. I can't do it. You can do it, but you can't do it alone. And you may not be around when the it that you're trying to do is ultimately accomplished, but just don't give up. Leverage your inner obsessive compulsive disorder, whatever it is. I'm serious, like I did, you know, just focus. Just keep grinding away at it.
There it is.
The fact that you, Glenn, did what you did back then, you didn't know where that was ultimately going to go. It seemed pretty hopeless, didn't it, in a lot of ways? It was like fighting against the Forest Service or cutting down trees. You know, it's like, okay, well, we got this one now. Where are they? Oh, they're down in Taylor Park.
Right?
But ultimately, the ball got picked up and carried on.
Yeah. Again,
some battles you lose and some you win, but in the big picture, it's important to keep locking arms with like-minded people and fighting the good fight.
Of course. Right.
Yeah, Rob, thanks so much for being with us on the show. A really positive story for folks to hear. And we want to have the same kind of enthusiasm for what we're working on here in New England as far as rewilding areas. And I'm looking forward to the day when wolves are reintroduced to the Adirondacks in New York State. And even New England.
So would it be.
Yeah. All right. Rob Edward, thanks so much for everything and for bringing us this story, and keep up the good work.
Oh, absolutely. I appreciate you having me on and all the work that you do.
Well, that was heartening. And when you were doing the intro, I was just thinking about here in the Connecticut River, mid-Connecticut River Valley. It's so heartening to see all the bear and the moose and the beaver come back. And most people are really accepting of it. And they're actually, a lot of people are enchanted by it. I know I certainly am. So that was great.
Yeah. You know, we'll always have conflicts between, you know, the human enterprise and wild nature. And you can think of beavers flooding roads. Well, that's a conflict because we want to be able to drive wherever we want, whenever we want to. But we also have to set aside large areas where the land is self-willed once again. And we've talked about that a lot on the show in the past. You know, the wildlands movement, the study that was done last year, Wildlands in New England study. And that's something that we need to be actively working towards, is the restoration of wildness. Back in the 1980s, I started working on wolf reintroduction back then, formed that nonprofit group, SynapU, to accomplish that. And here 35 years later, it has been accomplished. And that is, I think, an example or an indication of, you never know what your activism can result in. You know, I didn't know 35 years ago when I was promoting wolf reintroduction in the Northern Rockies that it would ever happen. I mean, it was Davy versus Goliath, and there was just opposition in every direction. But the amazing thing is that idea, you know, had a life of its own. An activist picked it up and carried it forward decade after decade until it was realized. And it's an amazing story, and it's one that we can really apply in our activism, because you never know, you can never predict how something will turn out. And I hate to be all gushy and positive about things, but that's one of the reasons why we need activism, is because these kinds of amazing miracles can actually happen when enough people persevere, when they're persistent and dedicated, then things can happen. And it's very similar to our last show where we talked with the young Girl Scouts, the young women who persevered against obstacles and saved a forest down in Maryland. And again, you know, this is an example in this show of how that kind of activism can pay off. So let's keep that in mind as we go forth and be engaged and active in protecting the earth.
Right. And there's some local examples right here in the Pioneer Valley, if they call it, the Mid-Connecticut River Valley. This is why there's no Nestle plant on the Montague Plains. There's no gas pipeline running through the Montague Plains on its way to the coast. Why there's no nuke on the Montague Plains. And that's just three examples right here.
Oh, yeah. Well, another example is that there's no biomass incinerator in Greenfield. And that was due to amazing activism. And that took a lot of people. And the result is that we have no CO2 spewing, forest destroying incinerator in the city of Greenfield. And we never will, because we put in place an ordinance that prohibits that kind of forest incinerator from ever being located here in Greenfield. So, you know, that's activism. That is what's needed more, you know, now than ever, climate activism. And there is so many opportunities. You just have to pick one of the thousand of different things that you can work on and then stick with it. And imagine that there will be people coming after you that will carry that further. And that's what happened in Colorado. And that's what needs to happen everywhere. And we all need to play our part in that.
That's right. And that's about it for this show. Except to remember to listen to your mother. This is Dio saying adios.
And I'm Glenn Ayers. And I hope this show's inspired you listeners to be active, get involved, make a difference, and respect the earth.
I am Mother Earth, and I approve of this message.